Live to see it, friends. You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist, and you can find us online at speculist.com. That's S-P-E-C-U-L-I-S-T.com. Or you can go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we talk about a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities that lie at the heart of this, the greatest era of transformation in human history. And Fast Forward Radio is your guide to a world that none of us really expect, but that'll probably be with us much sooner than we think. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hey, Stephen.
Hey, Phil.
Nice to be on the line here with you live.
That's right. I'm glad that you're feeling better.
I've got a good feeling about that. We got off to a late start this evening, and I'll tell you, I've got... what I can only describe as post-flu brain damage, I guess.
The fever was a little too high for a little too long.
I think so. I set the show up saying one time on the blog and another time on Blog Talk Radio. You point out the discrepancy, and I'm like, really? Is that why would I have? You know, I have no memory of ever having started the show at the half hour, and yet I think that's right. That's when we're supposed to start, isn't it? So
that's right. We've been on the half hour quite a while.
we forgot that somehow. And also, I can't, as we were discussing on chat before the program, I can't log in as myself. So
a multitude of issues, but we're dealing with them.
We're dealing with them. These are our tech problems of the week. We have a technical problem every week, and I'm afraid that the technical problem this week is lodged between Phil's ears. That's the that's the big
That's right. We are demonstrating idiocracy tonight.
It's interesting that we're going to be getting into that a little bit because it actually hits a little too close to home, as a matter of fact, that we're going to be talking about that a little bit. I don't know. I know we weren't able to change the time. Can we extend the end of the show? Can we go longer, or will that work?
I don't know. I'm afraid if I were to get in there and fiddle around with it at this point, we might end up losing the show altogether. So I say we complete the hour, and if we've got more to say, then we'll just, you know, our audience will just have to come back next week.
Okay. Well, apologize to all those who are listening to this after the fact. Because they missed the first half hour because they believed what the blog said rather than going to what the Fast Forward Radio site said. We did try to line the show up with what was published in the blog and weren't able to do that because I know Stephen noticed the mistake too. I never would have noticed the mistake. I would have thought we were doing it right. So very much my fault. I apologize for that. But, hey, we got a lot of great stuff that we want to talk about, and it's really wonderful to be back doing the program. So let's jump into it. I want to start off by talking about beverages, as is often the case, almost always the case. I'm having a nice cup of coffee,
right?
While we talk here this evening. And Stephen, I believe you're drinking something a little unusual.
Yeah, well, you know, water is not terribly unusual, but
that's true. Yeah,
but the source of this water certainly is. You know, I don't know about you, Phil, but I've always been blown away by each and every one of the TED Talks. I don't know what it is, but maybe they have lots of mediocre TED Talks, but they're never recorded and sent out to YouTube, because every one that I've seen has been interesting, just fascinating one way or another.
Absolutely, yeah.
And one in particular I thought was very interesting. Michael Pritchard is this gentleman's name, and he after Katrina and after the you remember when Malaysia got hit by the tsunami?
Oh yeah.
He saw the aftermath of those things and said, you know, there's got to be a better way than you know, having to ship in bottled water. There ought to be a way that we can help people use the water, the nasty water that's there, to make potable water out of it, drinkable water.
Right.
And he came up with what he called the Lifesaver bottle, which is a pump filtration bottle. Now, there have been pump filtration bottles in the past, lots of them, lots of different brands, but this particular one filters down to 15 nanometers, which is significant because viruses can be as small as 20 nanometers. In the past, there have been bottles that filter down to, you know, maybe 100 to 150 nanometers. But when you got holes that are that large in your filter, even bacteria are getting through, and certainly any virus can get through that. And so, with this, I mean, he demonstrated it in his TED talk by, you know, mixing this nasty water together with, you know, excrement and everything else, and then putting it in his bottle and pumping it, and out comes potable water, which he proceeded to drink, and he passed it around, and there, you know. And you know he believes in his product, and so I saw that and I was very impressed. And the key is, the idea is this, you know, what's the number one killer in the world as far as disease? And you've brought this up a couple of times, Bill.
It's dysentery, diarrhea.
That's right, particularly acute in places like Africa, any temperate climate. It's these problems can be very, very severe. And there's water everywhere, but, you know, water everywhere, not a drop to drink. Well, there's
exactly.
Water on the ground. There's, you know, and these people are drinking out of ditches and it's nasty stuff, and they're, you know, but what else are they going to do? And, of course, they get diarrhea and they die often, particularly very young. And the idea is this, that, you know, one family could take one of these Lifesaver bottles and have pure drinking water for a year or so. And so, anyway, I thought it was cool enough. I wanted to support the idea and you know, also, you know, just in case I needed it for hiking or camping or anything, I thought I'd get one. And so I did. And went out to my local pond and got some water in the Lifesaver bottle, and that's what I'm drinking tonight. So
you're sitting there drinking pond water, and I want everyone listening to understand, we're not just talking about pond water here. We're talking about Louisiana pond water, okay?
Oh, yeah. It's a good stuff. You can really sink your teeth into that. Now.
Yeah, this is the real stuff here, folks, okay? And how's it taste?
Delicious. It tastes like...
Yeah? I mean, it just tastes like fresh water? Or?
Yeah, it tastes like it tastes like bottled water.
Wow.
It's really good. It's very, very important to follow the instructions on the container. You have to prime it, and that means you have to put water through it about four or five times before you drink it. I did not do so, and man alive, that first time I drank some of it, it was nasty, and not because it was pond water coming through or anything like that. It was because you know, there's some stuff inside that's like a preservative that it has to wash off. And it apparently this water bottle is good on the shelf almost indefinitely, but once you start using it, it's good for 2 years.
Hmm.
And so anyway, whatever preservative was on it, it didn't taste good. And but after that's washed off and you follow the directions and do what you're supposed to do with it, then it's great after that. So
that's amazing. All right. Well, it's cool that, you know, you learned about something on a TED Talk and now you've purchased it, applied it into your own life, and it's a very handy thing. I mean, in addition to the major benefit that this technology can provide, which of course is relief in areas where people are in desperate need of good, clean drinking water, and they just don't have it. As you said, this has the application for camping, hiking. You know, just this whole problem of being around fresh water and not being able to access any of it is suddenly solved. And I think that there's probably some lesser emergency, you know, we're not going to have a tsunami probably in this country, but there are, you know, conceivable situations where suddenly you're out of water and it would be nice to be able to make use of a local source without having to worry about ending up in the hospital.
Oh, the other thing is soldiers in the field. That's, you know, a big logistics issue for the Pentagon is always, you know, having plenty of potable water. And, you know, this it's won all kinds of awards related to, you know, soldiers using it. So it's an interesting it has interesting applications, lots of interesting applications, and I hope that he continues to work with it and refine it. He's word is that he's working on one that would actually desalinate. This one will not, of course. Salt actually is it kind of makes it part of the solution, and so 15 nanometers is not sufficient to desalinate. So I'm not sure exactly how he'd have to do that or what the technology involved is, but apparently he's working on it. So,
very good. Hey, Stephen, let me jump in just now and address the chat room. They think we're playing audio from another show. No, we are going to get into the future of human evolution. We have suffered a few technical difficulties this evening. I'm personally not able to log into the chat, so I'm not able to respond on the chat room, but we are actually coming around to our other topics. I just started out talking about a really cool gadget that Stephen bought. So for those
the Lifesaver bottle. So yeah, if you're at all interested,
following
that,
in the chat.
Yeah, if you're all interested, check out the TED Talk we've already got posted in the show notes. So
and check out the awesome pictures of Stephen filtering water. Very cool stuff. So let's jump to our next topic, and let's talk a little bit about human evolution. Okay, because we've had some interesting threads kind of around that, and I've got another piece that I want to discuss in a little bit of length that I found over on Robin Hanson's blog. But just to start off with a couple of topics that we touched on over the weekend on the blog, we looked at this story about a justice of the peace who has come forward and said he doesn't want to perform interracial marriages, and we got into a discussion about how really as odd as that is and strange as that individual is, that really the fact that that's a newsworthy story kind of shows you how far we've come.
Yeah, I completely agree with that point. It's 10 years ago, I think it would have been news 10 years ago too, but there was a whole town basically, unfortunately, also in Louisiana, that didn't have any black people at all, and it was pretty much known that particular town, if you would be basically escorted to the city limits if you were a person of color. Well, of course, I mean that was just 10 years ago, believe it or not.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And of course that's changed. That's good, but I mean, yeah, you apparently still in some little backwater places in my home state, and probably in other places as well.
Other places too, for sure.
Yeah, other
absolutely.
Places too. That you're going to find, a few bigots, and that's what you got here. But the fact that it's news is wonderful. And the fact that everybody goes, can you believe this guy?
The fact that everybody looks at that and goes, that's shocking. The fact that we're shocked by it, I think is a very positive sign. Now, more positive would be for there not to be these things for us to be shocked by. Granted,
right.
But it's
rare enough that it's shocking, and that's good.
But that we're heading in that direction is a very good thing. And the interesting tit for tat we had on this was that I bring out this embarrassing story from your home state. So you responded with, let's look at what's going on in Colorado, shall we? And sure enough, we've got the very odd balloon boy story that unfolded last week. I tell you, I got in my car and started driving home from work the other day, and I thought I was listening to some kind of like War of the Worlds joke. Okay, I thought, is this April 1st? What are they saying? A kid is attached to a balloon that looks like a flying saucer out in Fort Collins? I can't remember. Was it Fort Morgan, Fort Collins? Anyway, one of the towns out east here, and I'm going, are they kidding? This has got to be a joke, right? And,
well, it is obviously, in a way, it was a joke. There's no, for one thing, there's no way that a kid of any size would have been lifted by that balloon. I've seen. Have you seen the video of it taking off?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, that thing would not have lifted a doctor.
But people seeing it on TV did not see it lift off, and they did not have a scale.
Right. It could have been the size of the Goodyear blimp. No one knew, based on just the pictures of it up in the sky, that it was too small. But of course, those who launched it knew. And I think that that's part of the problem that they're looking at. Never mind that the kid's saying it's for a show, you know. But it was I think that there'll be some charges filed. I'm sure.
It looks like they're heading in that direction. And I just want to give one more shout out to the chat room. Sorry, Sally, my bad on the time start. Feel free to call in if you want to join us live on the air as well. But thanks for joining in the chat room. So everyone who's been standing by in the chat room, Sally's with you now. So we can all start having fun. But the interesting thing today, they were playing on the local radio stations the 911 call from the family. I don't know if you've heard these. It was the local 911 call that he made, and the talk of the town here in Denver has been what a ridiculously bad actor this guy is, how bad his wife is, and how the operator, the 911 operator, sounds completely skeptical that anything's actually happening. I mean, like,
right.
She really doesn't buy it at all.
Well, I mean, but the 911 operator did what she was supposed to do. The police officers did what they were supposed to do. Everybody, you know, I mean, every aspect of this, Colorado can be applauded, I think, except for this mom.
Except for the parents.
Even the kid. I mean, he had the grace to get sick on TV about it. So, that's just the parents. Just the parents were acting poorly.
So, to me, the interesting thing, and let's go ahead and bring Sally on.
She is.
Hi.
Oh, hey, Sally.
Are you picking up my voice fairly well? I'm testing a new system.
Yeah, we can hear
you.
It's
a good night for that, actually. perfect show.
Yeah, I got a very cheap version of earphones and a small mic. So we'll see if people can hear me tonight.
So far, you sound great.
Oh, great. That's terrific.
Okay. Well,
I'm really sorry I didn't get the word that it was at 9 tonight, Central Time.
Well, it's my mistake. I apologize. Just to make it doubly confusing, I put the time one way, one place, and the other way, the other place. Just to allow for maximum confusion.
He's very dedicated.
We have a very smart audience. We present a moving target, and they still show up. So.
They still show up. That's right.
Yeah.
You got to love that about our audience. Absolutely. So, yeah, to me, the interesting question about the Balloon Boy story is, does this say something about maybe less positive about how we're evolving? Is Balloon Boy's dad with let's just assume for a moment that it is a hoax, seems to be. This, like, need to, you know, these people who appear on reality TV shows and then create this elaborate situation to get themselves back on TV, is this like a, certainly not a new pathology, but is it worse? You know?
The opportunity to have this pathology where you just need the attention and all that. I guess, you know, with things like reality TV, all of a sudden you have that. You know what this guy should have done? He should have gotten a podcast. You know, I mean,
hey, if you want attention,
get a podcast and be, you know, you can get on, you know, get on the radio or act like you're on the radio and say all kinds of crazy things, and you know, people probably listen to this guy. But you know, to create this situation and it look like, you know, a child is in danger, that's not cool at all.
No, it's not, and it's indicative of, I mean, if you look at the whole kind of age of reality TV, there has been a kind of constant, relentless, I don't know whether to call it raising, or it's probably more appropriate to say lowering of the bar, this just increasing amount of humiliation and degradation that people will expose themselves to in order to get on TV.
Yeah.
And you have to go, well, you know, if that's the direction we're heading, that's probably not too good. And that's, I think, what kind of takes us to the discussion of Idiocracy. 2006 movie, and Stephen, you said you have seen this. Is that right?
I have seen it. It's one of these, you know, I was flipping through, you know, couldn't sleep, two in the morning, and there it is on HBO or something. I forget, and I probably missed the first 10-15 minutes, but I got the gist. I got the gist. So
yeah, well, and the gist is I would like to have actually taken the audio from the first few minutes, but from a language standpoint, it's not appropriate for our program, so I opted not to do it. But the beginning of the movie. Starts out explaining how the world has come to be as it's portrayed in this movie. The movie's set in the year, I believe, 2500, and this is not the Buck Rogers 25th century, although that would be the 26th century, actually. But this is not a happy post-Star Trek future at all. This is a badly degraded world because the people are really, really stupid. And the explanation that's given up front is that, and in fact, it's a time travel story because the protagonist, Owen Wilson, moves ahead in the future. He becomes the smartest man in the world, and he was like, I'm going to say, average to well below average in intelligence.
He was actually kind of dumb, actually, but he and dumb enough that he accidentally got himself frozen. You know, that's how he moved ahead in time. He was
It was a bad deal all the way around. So one of our dumbest people today goes to the year 2500. He's one of the smartest people there. How does this happen? Well, they explain how it happens, and they show the split screen story of two families. And you've got on the one hand this yuppie couple. He's got a 138 IQ. She's got a 141 IQ, and they're waiting to the right minute, to the right year, until everything's perfect before they have a child. And on the right, you see this
a less intelligent couple.
A somewhat less intelligent couple. I don't remember what the IQ rankings for them were, but they were down somewhat. And these were like the folks you see on Jerry Springer or a show like that. I mean, this is like the guy he's got several kids with the wife. He's got several more with the woman in the trailer next door, and then somebody else shows up a few minutes into it, presumably a few years later, and he's had children by her too. So you see this family tree just massively expanding, and it appears that the correlation they're making is the dumber you are, the more kids you have,
yeah.
And the smarter and more sophisticated you are, the fewer children you have. Now, actually, that's not entirely wrong. There is.
I, for example, have four kids. Sorry, go ahead.
Whereas I only have two, so you can see that they're. Yeah. No, I that's great. No, I didn't mean it any people we know. What we know is, for example, in the West, where particularly Western Europe, you've got this extreme drop in birth rates among well-developed countries, whereas in less developed countries, you've got higher birth rates. Now, that doesn't necessarily map to intelligence. In the movie, they make it that smart people have fewer kids, like lower economic status people have a lot more kids, and their kids have kids younger, and then the thing just sort of reproduces on itself until you have this kind of idiot world. Now, my question to you, Stephen, is what do you make of that theory? Would that happen?
Well, I think, the more developed a country is, later we wait to have children, the fewer children we have, things like that. But I think sometimes we flatter ourselves with, well, we're a developed country, therefore we're smarter. Not necessarily. There's probably some genius guys out in the bush, in Africa, their genius is to stay alive, and they're operating with a whole different set of problems than we face, and so I don't think that part of staying alive is at least intergenerationally is to have plenty of children so that some of them reach adulthood. And so maybe that's part of what they're facing there. So I don't necessarily buy it completely, but there's probably some truth to it.
Yeah, in fact, I think that was the real error that the movie makes, is that it equates education and economic development with intelligence, which is not true at all. You know,
right.
that's the thing. The notion that affluent people who dress nice have high IQs and poor people who live in trailers have low IQs. Yeah, there's going to be some correlation there, but it's not going to be nearly as linear as what they're talking about at all.
Right.
And certainly not between affluence and poverty, between different countries. So yeah, I think the premise is way overstated to begin with. The other thing
Also the Darwin Award factor too. I mean, if you're dumb enough, you're probably going to get yourself killed. You know, before you reproduce. So,
yeah.
I mean, there's always that to consider. So,
yeah. Well, I guess that was part of the point was that the natural selection pressure has been removed, and now you don't really have to be all that bright to reproduce. Which I guess when you see the typical Jerry Springer type show, you would say, oh yeah, you know, there probably is something to that for sure.
Jaywalking and those
others. Yeah, or jaywalking or something like that. It's not there's not a huge intelligence bar that's been raised. But I think I think it falls down on two things. First, on conflating one with the other, and I don't think they're the same thing. And the other is that I don't actually think that people would get dumber. I think they would get smart slower, even if that was what was happening. As an actual projection of how the future will unfold, I think it's wrong. As a kind of a satire of the world we live in today, which I think is what the movie was actually intended to be.
Yeah,
it kind of worked. I liked the drinking fountains that sprayed Gatorade. That you couldn't get water anywhere, right? If you ask for water, they're like, "What? You mean like in a toilet?"
Nobody drinks that stuff.
Yeah, they all drink this like sports drink, and the idea that the Supreme Court had become the extreme court.
That's right.
I just got kind of a kick out of that. I enjoyed that.
Yeah, it was a funny movie. I recommend if anybody hadn't seen it, yeah, go see it before we spoil it for you. But
before we spoil any more of it. But hopefully we've picked at the premise enough. So that people don't really believe that people are getting stupider, because I really don't think that's true. I think that all evidence indicates that people are getting smarter.
There's actually a book that I've mentioned a couple of times on this show. Everything bad is good for you. That's the name.
Right. Right.
And the whole premise of that book is sort of to say, you know, these fuddy duddies that sit around going, "Why in my day we didn't have all these video games and kids weren't watching as much TV and all these things." Well, this particular guy, you know, he did the study on these various things like video games, and you know, a typical video game requires a lot of brain power to to get to the end of it these days. We're not dealing with Pac-Man anymore. It's some of these things are very, very sophisticated, and you got 13-year-olds solving these things, then they're going to be that's a pretty big challenge. So that's the premise of the book, that the things that we say are bad for, particularly for kids, maybe sometimes they're not so bad, maybe.
Yeah, it's really interesting that things like that you wouldn't expect, for example, that television show plot lines have become much more sophisticated and require
right.
a lot more intelligence to follow than they did back in the heyday of TV. That in fact it takes as much or more smarts to live today than it did at any other time. It probably takes those smarts directed differently, and that's where we see that's where we see a big drop off in skills that were important in the past. And my favorite example of that, of course, is penmanship, because I never had that one anyway. So. I kept saying, you know what, I'm not going to need this. I think we'll have typewriters and stuff. So.
And you turned out to be correct. So.
I feel very vindicated by just once again want to thank the computer revolution for coming along and backing me up on that one. So, but now I want to take this a step further, and I want to talk about a blog post that I read over on Robin Hanson's blog. And you're familiar with Robin Hanson, economist. We've cited him, you know, quite a few times talking about issues related to the increase in wealth and why we're as rich today as kings were back in the back in the Middle Ages. He's a very interesting genius polymath economist, philosopher, scenarist in this instance, drawing out where he thinks the future is going to take us. And I was really...
At the Overcoming Bias blog, by the way.
Yes, the blog is called Overcoming Bias, and we'll, of course, provide the link here. I'm going to read some excerpts from this at some length just to kind of get the message across. He starts out with a little blurb from Wikipedia talking about this concept of the dream time. He says, Aboriginals believe in a dream time, more real than reality itself. Whatever happens in the dream time establishes the values, symbols, and laws of Aboriginal society. It is also often used to refer to an individual's or group set of beliefs or spirituality. It's a complex network of knowledge, faith, and practices that derive from stories of creation. So it's the prehistory of the Aboriginal people. They believe they come out of this dream time when everything sort of coalesced, and that led to their existing. Now, Robin Hanson says that we live in the dream time today. And let me read just a little bit of this. In the distant future, our descendants will probably have spread out across space and redesigned their minds and bodies to explode Cambrian style into a vast space of possible creatures. If they're free enough to choose where to go and what to become, our distant descendants will fragment into diverse local economies and cultures. Given a similar freedom of fertility, most of our distant descendants will also live near a subsistence level. Per capita wealth has only been rising lately because income has grown faster than population. But if income only doubled every century in a million years, that would be a factor of 10 to the 3,000th, which seems impossible to achieve with only 10 to the 70 atoms in our galaxy available by then. So he's, you know, a few assumptions there that within a million years we would only be to the edge of the galaxy. 10 to the 70 atoms. But wealth would need to be at 10 to the 3,000 to continue increasing at the rate that it's currently increasing. Yes, we have seen a remarkable demographic transition wherein richer nations have fewer kids, but we already see contrarian subgroups like Hutterites, and I assume this is pronounced Hmongs, or Mormons, that grow much faster. So unless strong central controls prevent it, over the long run, such groups will easily grow faster than the economy, making per-person income drop to near subsistence levels. So he's not talking about people becoming stupid, but he is laying this kind of Malthusian image of the future out, wherein we're going through this temporary blurb where wealth has outgrown population, but he says that quickly that's going to reverse, and population will once again begin to outgrow wealth. So he continues, when our distant descendants think about our era, however, differences will loom large. They will see that we were more like them in knowing more things and in having less contact with wild nature. But our brief period of very rapid growth and discovery in our globally integrated economy and culture will be quite foreign to them. Yet even these differences will pale relative to one huge difference. Our lives are far more dominated by consequential delusions, wildly false beliefs and non-adaptive values that matter. While our descendants may explore delusion-dominated virtual realities, they will well understand that such things cannot be real and don't much influence history. In contrast, we live in the brief but important dream time when delusions drove history. Our descendants will remember our era as the one where the human capacity to sincerely believe crazy, non-adaptive things and act on those beliefs was dialed to the max. So he gives some examples here. This is very interesting. He talks about how our knowledge has been growing really fast, and it's bringing about radical changes, and in fact that we've seen the world change so much that people are capable of believing that anything is possible, so that nothing really gets labeled a delusion. Then he talks about the fact that because we're so wealthy, relatively, we have big buffers of wealth that allow us to cushion our mistakes, and we can live happily and long, even while acting on crazy beliefs. Now, that second one put me in mind of the great economic experiments of the 20th century.
Yeah.
When you think about, well, let's try socialism, let's try communism, let's try, you know, it's very interesting when you think about how rapidly our knowledge has grown.
Right.
If you go back to the most basic of tools, right, we really know how to build a knife or a hammer, right? And even since ancient times, I think we've had a really good idea of how to make a basic structure. You know, we know the Romans figured out how to make an arch. We know how to build a foundation for a building. We really, and even up to like making a city, we have a really good idea of how to do that, how to lay out the roads, what the drainage should be, how traffic should flow, what kind of materials to use. You know, we've solved those kinds of problems. But if you keep layering it on, you say, well, how do you build a whole society? How do you build a whole economy? Do we know how to do that? We think we do, or we think we're getting better at it, but within our lifetimes, we've seen human attempts to put those things together come crashing down around them. And so I can definitely see Hansen's point here about our ability to be deluded.
Well, I'm going to take issue with him. You know, basically, if you were to buy what he is saying, then you're going to have to do one of two things. You're either going to have to you need to relinquish wealth or control the number of kids people have, or both. And frankly, you know, I'm not ready to give a centralized government that kind of power over my life. I wouldn't want to live in a society like that. And I think that that's kind of, and I may be reading too much into it, but I think that that's where he's going with this.
Well, you know what? I can't quite figure that out, and I've read this about three times now. I can definitely plausibly see that as one of the possible conclusions you would draw from that, but I'm not sure that I read that that's what that's what Hansen is suggesting that we have to. Let me share a few more of these delusions and see if any of them resonate. He talks about we've evolved to signal various features of ourselves to one another via delusions. So a lot of the behavior we engage in, we're not doing it for the reasons that we think we are. And he gives the examples. We think we pay for doctors to help our loved ones get well rather than to show that we care, which is the actual motivation that drives us to do that. Of course, we can have more than one intention at the same time. But he talks about we think we do politics because we want to help our nation rather than to signal character and loyalty. Well, this is actually one of the reasons I get frustrated with political discussions, is because it seems that the signaling that goes on often takes precedence over the trying to achieve a particular good outcome. But he goes on and says, while our ancestors' delusions were well adapted to their situations and didn't hurt them much, the same delusions are not nearly as adapted to our rapidly changing world, and our signaling-induced delusions hurt us more. So he talks about investments and the difficulty of getting a return on those. He talks about our minds having been built in near mode, and which means we're designed for practical and concrete reasoning about things that are up close, and a far mode, which is designed for presenting a good image to others via abstract reasoning. And now we have to deal with a much larger world where there's just a lot more going on in far mode, and where probably the mix between the two used to be 80-20 near to far, it probably has to switch. And we talk about some of these kinds of things on this program sometimes. So we rely more than our ancestors did on this far mode capability, and we just haven't really caught up with the ability to handle that, to do that. So he goes on to say that all these factors come together and they make us the most consistently and consequentially deluded and unadaptive humans that have ever lived on the earth. To me, that seems harsh. I can't help but feel that that's harsh. But the point here is that
it's facts of Schadenfreude to me. I mean, it's the sort of thing, you know, let's beat up on ourselves because that's fun. You know, I mean, I think I might be being a bit harsh on him, but it doesn't. You know, just because, you know, a lot of people just get a kick out of sometimes beating up on our society, our time, or whatever, and it just smacks a little bit of that to me.
Yeah, well, and in fact, one of the commenters pointed that out. It had an interesting quote from Jonathan Swift talking about how it was one of his long poems, The Tale of the Tub, where Swift chronicles all these, like, stupid delusions that people have these days. And, of course, this is in the 1600s.
Yeah.
And pointed out that people have always been deluded, and there have always been some people who have pointed it out. So so that to say that we're unique is maybe to push it. However, we have to look at it from the standpoint of, we always do point out what a unique period of human history this is. So the thing that gets my attention here as I look at this is I go, well, it's true. If all of our good plans for bringing about the singularity, or, you know, avoiding existential risks, are that much more leveraged because of the time that we live in, then I guess our delusions probably are too. If we're not looking at the world right, if we're kidding ourselves about what reality is, or the relationships that we have to the world or with each other, then we actually are in a unique position, oddly enough, to do more harm maybe than our ancestors did, just because we've got this technological civilization that's about to burst into something else. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes sense. Yeah, it's similar to the mad scientist idea. You might want to
Moore's law for mad scientists.
Thank you. Moore's law for mad scientists. It's very, very, very close in flavor to that, which is the idea that every year the IQ necessary to destroy the world drops by 1 point or something like that every 14 months or something. But anyway, that's the idea, and because we have the power to cause more mischief now than ever before, and hopefully our ability to prevent mischief will grow along the same lines. So
exactly, yeah, and I just want to point out three comments that I found particularly interesting. For one thing, you've got among others Anders Sandberg, J. Storrs Hall, and Eliezer Yudkowsky chiming in on this. On this post. So one thing is just a real privilege to read something like this. You know, it's like really unusual view, very kind of difficult to deal with, and I'm sure I haven't done it justice, set of concepts that Hansen has laid out. But then to see, I think some of the smartest people in the world, okay, contending with these ideas and discussing them with Robin, it's what a glorious era that we live in, that we've got the blogosphere, and when, you know, the smart people get together and have a conversation, we get to listen in, which I just think is really cool.
Yeah, I like the way you said that. We lesser mortals can listen.
I haven't deigned to leave a comment myself. You know, it would have been something like, yeah, cool. But
you guys are awesome.
Yeah, you guys rock. But listen, this is really interesting. Listen to what Anders wrote. He's been a guest on Fast Forward Radio. He says, the fact that our descendants will likely have utterly different values will still not impair our ability to make predictions about the low-level constraints on their behavior. The observer of the nucleic acid ocean, so he's talking about back in the, you know, 3 billion years back in our history, would be able to predict that in 3 billion years' time there would still be competition for nucleotide raw material. They would just not be able to say what kinds of conglomerates would be doing the competition and how they would be going about it. But they would likely be able to predict with a high confidence that the era of replicators having a large soup of free nucleotides to use would be drawing to a close, never to reoccur. Maybe our subsistence-level descendants are like our poor nucleic acids, struggling to survive within the 10 to the 30th power cells of the biosphere, while pretty oblivious to how the amazing creatures built on top of them enjoy life. So, to me, it felt like what Anders is saying is, even if Hansen's prediction of this kind of Malthusian, you know, we're out across the entire galaxy, but everyone's kind of struggling at the subsistence level, even if that's true, that actually won't reflect the reality any more than the fact that our DNA kind of has this Malthusian existence. That doesn't reflect the fact that we have this very rich existence that we live, because that's what makes it up. So that was an interesting idea. Then J. Storrs Hall comes in. Josh Hall says, I think the reasons you list for this being the age of delusion are mostly contributing factors to the real engine of the phenomenon, which is that our political system has evolved to such a state that it is advantageous for the most powerful in society to promote widespread belief in various falsehoods. The result is an educational system which is incompetent in teaching people to value and how to seek the truth. A huge industry selling FUD, which is, what is that, fear? What is FUD?
I will look it up while you talk.
Okay, I should know this. We talk about it in marketing all the time.
Is it just
anyway,
FUD?
Yes.
All right, I'll look it up.
A huge industry selling FUD as its major product.
Fear, uncertainty, and doubt.
thank you, Fear, Uncertainty, and Doubt, as its major project, and the growth of fundamentalist earth worship in the guise of and displacing real science. So a much harsher take on politics than I was giving it from Josh, but this this idea that maybe our political rhetoric has gotten a little bit out of control, and that we're so busy condemning the evil villains that are on the other side, and in fact putting that into terms of fear, uncertainty, and doubt, that we don't actually get people closer to the truth via our political process. Finally, Eliezer Yudkowsky comes in, and he reiterates something Robin wrote, which was this: perhaps most dramatic will be tragedies about Dreamtime advocates who could foresee and were horrified by the coming slow, stable, adaptive eons and tried passionately but unsuccessfully to prevent them. I read that, and it was just like, wow, this is a really sweeping view of the future history of humanity, a million years into the future. And here you have these beings looking back at us and saying they blew it, essentially, right? So Ellie writes, yeah, I guess I don't ultimately understand the psychology that can write that and not fight fanatically to the last breath to prevent the dark vision from coming to pass. How awful would things have to be before you fight to stop it, before you would do more than sigh in resignation? If no one were ever happy or sad, if no one ever told a story or bothered to imagine that things could have been different, would that be awful enough? And that's kind of where I think I am with this. And I think that's what we're about on this program, because we can look at really a terribly bleak, what looks like a terribly bleak version, although later in the comments Robin says, no, I think this actually represents about probably 90% of the best case scenario, which actually let Eliezer go, well, what's 100% look like then? Jeez, I mean, pretty far from the mark to me. But I think that I think Ellie's right on track there, right? We want to make sure that that we are guiding our evolution into the correct direction. So whether it's away from racism. And I think maybe away from an obsessive need for media attention, destructive anyway, obsessive destructive need for media attention, whether it's away from, you know, kind of ignorance and this kind of degradation of the culture, but also I think whether it's away from this kind of Malthusian nightmare of humanity surviving, and you know, when you read this is really even a post-singularity world he's talking about. He's talking about beings that have access to these technologies and could possibly live for very long periods of time, but because there are so many of them competing for such a small number of resources, they end up at, most of them end up at this subsistence level. So I think even in the face of this kind of very well articulated scenario, we have to look at that and go, yes, this, like the big meteor hitting the Earth, you know, like the hard takeoff of the unfriendly AI, this is one of the scenarios that is off the path, and that we should be actively working to avoid that. And I would agree with you completely, Stephen, that if the solution to that is that a big centralized government is going to step in and say, who can have kids, then the solution might be actually worse than the problem that we're trying to solve. But if it's more a matter of getting to the singularity the right way, having an understanding of making the best use of those resources, so that we don't fall into that kind of trap, then I think that's the way we have to go.
You know, one possible future is sort of being ignored by this, and that is the possibility of living within various virtual realities, simulated universes, things like that. I mean, you know, you run out of space or run out of atoms in this galaxy, well, you simulate a whole other universe that you could populate. So, I mean, I think that's perhaps one solution to that problem. So,
right, although I think he actually mentions that and talks about ultimately the computing resources themselves competing with each other. I mean, he's talking about some fairly far out stuff there, but I, to me it seems like the solution ultimately would be what John Smart talked about a month or so ago when we had him on the show, where we start working our way in right? If nanotechnology doesn't get us far enough, femtotechnology will, and if that doesn't, we'll probably discover something smaller down one layer deeper than that as we wind our way down and perhaps completely out of this universe altogether.
You know, I think this idea that that something that we do wrong in this time, beyond wiping ourselves out, you know, if we don't wipe ourselves out, and we muddle along somehow, then what we do in this time is going to be of little consequence to people a million years from now. I mean, it'd be a little bit like us going, you know, those bacteria, they just really blew it, you know. you know, just. It seems to me, you know, it just seems to me that surviving and getting along somehow or another, dealing with the problems that we have at hand, you know, I don't think that we need to have a centralized government telling us how many kids we can have at this point and relinquishing this or that or any of these other engineered solutions are going to matter a million years from now, but it sure would matter now. You know?
Yeah. Well, the interesting thing about that is it might matter a lot, but you're right, in hindsight it won't. Because you know what? The bacteria probably could have done something a lot better than they did. But we don't see that now, right? I mean, the whole world might actually be better off if the Neanderthals had made it and we hadn't, right? But we're certainly not going to see it that way. So I think you make an excellent point. Nobody's going to look back a million years later at the dream time and say, yeah, they blew it. Because people look at the world that they're given, don't they? I mean,
yeah. Exactly.
That's an excellent point you make, Stephen. Okay, well, that takes us right to the end. We didn't get a chance to check back in. I saw some really good stuff happening in the comments, but I know we're going to hit our time here. So tell me about the music, Stephen.
Well, the song is Melody Sings by the band A Fresh Sunday.
A Fresh Sunday Sings, Melody Sings. All right, well, that sounds great. Well, Stephen, it's great being back on the show. Sounds like you're doing well with your pond water, so
yeah,
keep up to your good health on that. I drink to you. Sally, thanks for joining us, everyone in the chat room and everyone listening live. Thanks for being part of the program. We'll be back on at the regular time next week on the regular day, regular time, and I look forward to being with you all then. Until then, live to see it.
Sometimes I hear your voice.